Coming up Saturday at 2 on Hometown Heroes, a 91-year-old veteran of World War II in Korea, he's lived with waist-down paralysis for the last 56 years after a devastating accident that killed his father.
The locomotive T-boned a 35 forward, and that's where I ended up paralyzed. For 3 days, they gave me up as deceased, and I fooled them, and I'm still here today.
Yes, he is, and you'll hear his story on Hometown Heroes, Saturday afternoon at 2 on News Talk 920 KVEC.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who have done remarkable things for the sake of our freedom, and who maybe if we hear their stories, we don't take as much for granted ourselves. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifices. We want to make sure their stories are preserved so we don't forget the price paid for our freedom. And along the way, we always learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, oftentimes inspired. And I'm sure that'll be the case today with 91-year-old Frank Rigo of Phoenix, Arizona, originally from Prescott, Arizona, a little north of here. And we're going to hear a little bit also before we're done about the paralyzed veterans of America, because he's one of them. It didn't happen in the war. It happened afterwards, but we'll get that story. Let's start early on. Growing up in Prescott, Arizona, you had three brothers, two sisters. Both your parents were Italian immigrants. What was life like? What were your big plans for life as a boy growing up in Prescott?
Well, it was it came sudden on me. I was in high school, and from high school, I went into service. Didn't have much time to plan anything.
It seems like everybody has a memory of that, how they heard that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor. Do you remember how you got that news?
I was working in a grocery store at that time while I was going to school. And I remember on that, it was a Sunday afternoon, and we were making sausages. And we were tying sausages into links like Broxford. I remember just as vivid today as it was then when Roosevelt said, "I have declared war on the Japanese." And the Japanese were here visiting. They did the sneak attack on Pearl Harbor while they were here in Washington, D.C.
For a teenager to hear that news, was that a big deal? I mean, did that rock your world a little bit? What did that mean to you at the time?
It meant we were going to go to war, and it wouldn't be long, we'd be gone. And I graduated in June of 42, and in January of 43, I was in the service.
But before that, you found another way to contribute to the war effort, because down in San Diego, they were building B-24s, and you got some experience with that. You worked in the Consolidated Aircraft Plant. What'd you do on those B-24s?
On the B-24s, I worked on the wings. We were building the spar for the wing, and the wing was basically a flying gas can, and that's where they put all the fuel in it. And I wanted to be a gunner in the belly of one of those B-24s, but ended up going to pilot school, and then when they had so many pilots, I went into radio from there.
And before that, while you were still at the B-24 factory, I think this is interesting. The manufacturing effort in World War II was how fast they produced all these airplanes. And we've heard about Willow Run in the Midwest and how quickly they turned out these plane parts. But you got some of those parts in San Diego, and they didn't fit quite right. Tell us what you had to do to those wings that came from Willow Run to make sure they actually would attach on those B-24s.
The wing was an eighth of an inch too long to where they couldn't use the flaps. So I was on a stool that had three casters on it with a drill motor grinding the eighth of an inch off the trailing edge of that wing. And we were working 12 hours a day, no Sundays off, 7 days a week. And I did that for about 3 months. We had about 120 of those wings that were shipped from Willow Run to San Diego that were an eighth of an inch too wide. Instead of junk them, we made them fit.
Grinding down wings all day long, I'm sure that noise would get tired, the vibrations you'd get tired of. What did you think about when you're doing that hour after hour after hour?
I was getting paid, and it was a job. And I was a young kid, not knowing any better, and so that's what it amounted to. And it was great to get it.
Well, and I guess if you guys didn't do that, then there were some B-24s that weren't going to get made, and there were some pilots and crewmen who weren't going to have a plane to fly, huh? I mean, is it as simple as that?
That's as simple as that. It was, we were cranking them planes out in 3 or 4 days sometime.
So you kind of gave us the scoop there. You wanted to fly after that experience in the aircraft factory. You went to pilot training. They had enough pilots. They turned into a radio and radar man. You did end up going overseas. Before we get to your experiences, I'm just curious. You had three brothers. Did any of them end up serving in the war as well?
All three of them served. My youngest brother served in the Korean War, and my older brother served in England. The other brother worked at the proving grounds in California there, where Yeager did all the flying and everything. Oh. Mojave, He spent his time up in Mojave.
So your mom had four boys that were in the service. She must have done a lot of praying, huh?
I lost my mom in 38 with double pneumonia, so she was up there watching over me, I guess.
So tell me about your adventures. What kind of training did you go through? What are the things that you learned in the Army Air Corps?
From pilot school, then I went to radio school, radio and radar, to repair. Then when I went overseas, we were in a communication department with the guerrillas in the Philippines. I was on my way to invade Sasebo, Japan when they dropped the second bomb and the Japanese gave up.
Good thing they dropped the second bomb and you didn't have to do that because you might not be here talking to me. You're talking about the Philippines and working with those guerrillas. This is the 37th Fighter Control Squadron. What did that mean? Who were you communicating for? What did that squadron consist of?
We were also working with them mainly fighter planes, P-38s, P-47s, get in contact with them and like landing and everything like that. It was a variety of different jobs. With our radar, we could find where the enemies were at also. It worked both ways, keeping track of ours and keeping the enemy in check to see where keep them away from the troops.
So give me a taste, if you can, of one of those days for you. You go in, you're in an office somewhere in the Philippines. Where were you in the Philippines?
In a tent. That was the office, a tent. In the Philippines, it was sort of winding down, and they were cutting back on a lot of things. They used to call them DF vans with all the equipment in it. When we moved on, we couldn't take them with us, so we had to destroy them so nobody could get a use them against us.
Today, we say radar, everybody knows what that is. In fact, some people are saying, oh, that's what that cop holds up when he pulls me over with the speeding ticket. But back in 1944, 1945, radar was a pretty new thing. Was it kind of a neat adventure for you to get in on the ground floor of radar and get to figure out how this thing worked? And tell us what it was like. How would you operate that system?
Well, I'll never forget one time in the Korean War, the radar picked up an identified object, and we scrambled some fighters to go intercept. We were up at Mather Air Force Base next to Sacramento, and we found a flock of geese flying at 11,000 feet, and the radar picked up. The pilot said, it's a flock of geese, but we picked them up on radar flying.
Wasn't a UFO. No conspiracy theories there, just a bunch of honking geese. But so during World War II, when you're using this radar equipment, what would you see, and how could you tell what was what? Can you describe for us how that worked, or how you carried out your job?
Tubes on those units then were round, and you had a hand that went around just like an hour hand on a clock, and the planes would show up as a blip on the tube, and that's how we could keep track of who was where. And then we had a height finder where we could tell how high the plane was flying.
How could you tell if a plane was American or Japanese or something else? Was there any way to tell?
The only way you could tell that back then was to know where our planes were at, and there's something in the sky that wasn't supposed to be there. According to our records, then it was an enemy.
But from the radar display itself, there is no differentiation. A blip is a blip, whether it's American or Japanese, so Sounds like there was probably a fair amount of guesswork or just logical conclusions you had to make.
Well, that's true, but you also knew where yours were supposed to be at.
Were there ever some tense moments for you over there where you felt like maybe people's lives depended on what you were doing or what message you relayed or how you handled the situation?
Back then, you didn't think about the things. You just thought, well, let's do the best you can to save as many as you could. You don't have time to think about it.
What part of the Philippines was that? Which island were you on?
Going to the Philippines, I landed at Luzon and then went up to Clark Field. Spent my time at Clark Field. Weather, when those typhoons come by, you really know they're coming by.
Well, it sounds like there's some stories there. What do you remember about those typhoons?
You see a breeze blowing and everything gets just as still as can be. And that you know that within 15, 20 minutes, you're going to be blown away if you don't get in a hole or something. You're going to get wet, too.
So you guys had some holes dug or some shelters you'd get into or what?
You never knew where you were going to be at when they came. And so you just did the best of what you had.
And what goes through your mind when you're hunkered down like that waiting for this thing to pass? I mean, I can't imagine what that...
Well, it's... You don't have time, basically, to think about it. You just do what you can do best for the moment.
And you mentioned when you first described going overseas for that duty that you did some coordinating with Filipino guerrilla troops that were fighting alongside Americans.
There was a lot of Filipinos that came with them along with the American forces. They just grabbed a gun and came along.
You were coordinating with these air forces, but you also had to know where the ground troops were and what areas were held by Americans, what areas might not be. What kinds of things were you doing there?
They were just trying to find the movements of the troops, where the concentration was. If it needed bombs, they could go bomb them.
Well, and you mentioned bombs. Did it ever occur to you that where you were might be a target, that you could come under enemy attack?
You're never free of that. You were vulnerable just as they were from us. Where I was at, I never did get that close except for some Japanese that would sneak in. And basically, they weren't sneaking in to hurt us. They were sneaking in to try and get food.
Were you getting a sense that the war was winding down, that the Allies were close to a victory? I mean, did you have a feeling that that was going to happen? Or were you thinking, hey, we're going to have to go invade Japan?
I was on my way to invade Japan, and I was sailing by Okinawa on an LST on the way to Japan when they surrendered. So I don't know what would have happened. Probably wouldn't be here because we landed in Sasebo, and there was just the hillside was full of caves. They would just shoot us like ducks in a rain barrel.
So that's where you ended up landing after the surrender, but that's the same spot you guys would have landed had there been an invasion?
Same spot, so might not be here today for if it hadn't surrendered.
So I guess you applauded President Truman for making that decision to drop the bomb?
It's a terrible bomb, but it did the job.
And do you have any idea what you would have been doing with those invasion forces? Would it have been the same thing that you were going there to set up a radar and radio outpost?
That's what we were going to do, and it never came about, thank God.
How long were you over there in occupation duty?
Came home, like I say, on an escort carrier. I had a bunch of Japanese planes, bombers, and Zeros on it. I landed in San Pedro about the 18th or 19th of December.
So you were there in Japan for a good couple months then, huh?
They put us on a train and took us to Tokyo, and I sailed out of Tokyo Bay coming home. And I went through Hiroshima.
Well, that was my question. If you were over there in Japan for that long, you must have seen some things. What did you see there? And what did it do to you to look at that complete devastation?
Hiroshima, sometime right here, they tear a house down and haul all the rubbish away and rake the lot, and it's flat and clean after demolishing a house. That's what the whole city of Hiroshima was like. When I went through it, they put new tracks for the trains, but there was nothing left. You never thought that there was a city, that there was nothing left.
Was that difficult to look at for you emotionally? Did it weigh on you to see that?
Well, you didn't give it a thought, you know. Like I say, everything was just swept clean. There was no rubbish or anything because it all burned up. They say the city was there, but there was no more city, no street. There was no signs of any streets or fire plugs or anything. It just was wiped clean, burned off the face of the earth.
People my age have grown up our whole lives knowing about that and knowing that that was possible. But I imagine for someone like you to see that and realize, wow, there's something that can do this, that can just obliterate an entire city like that, that had to be eye-opening or kind of shocking. Do you remember processing that this is even possible?
I was thinking I was real fortunate that they surrendered, or I wouldn't have been on that train heading for Tokyo. And so I was young, and I didn't give that much consideration to think, it's possible that they could blow the whole city off the map.
I can sure see how that would stick with you. We need to catch our first commercial break here, but there's much more to come on today's program. We're going to wrap up Frank's World War II experience and then let him explain how he became involved with the Paralyzed Veterans of America. It wasn't what he wanted. In fact, it was a devastating accident. But when you hear his attitude after living with paralysis for more than a half century, I'm pretty sure it's going to give you a little perspective and perhaps some inspiration as well. Before we're done today, I'm also going to take you to one of the most impressive World War II-themed museums that I've had the chance to visit. If you ever make your way through West Texas, it needs to be on your list. We're going to get to that, but it's back to Frank Rigo's story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with a man who has seen life for the last 56 years through a little different lens than most of us. For a 91-year-old, he has impressive upper body strength, and you can thank 56 years of wheeling himself around in a wheelchair for that. Frank Rigo is one of the elder statesmen of the Paralyzed Veterans of America. His injuries did not take place during his time in the U.S. Army Air Corps in World War II, or what had become the U.S. Air Force by the time he served in the Korean War. It came later on, and his experience has proven valuable to the servicemen who come home paralyzed from the wars our country is still involved in today. Frank lives in Phoenix, Arizona. He grew up north of there in Prescott, but when we left off, he was describing a much different setting, the aftermath of the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. Frank went through on a train shortly before coming home from occupation duty in Japan at the end of World War II. And, of course, we're in the midst of the holiday season now, but 69 years ago, Frank wasn't quite sure he was going to make it home for Christmas, and he needed a little help from a motivated skipper and a future presidential candidate to pull it off. Let's jump back into the interview right there. The story of you coming back is a good one, and I'm sure, you know, we always learn something on this show. I'm sure most people don't realize that just because you sail back from the East to the States doesn't mean that there's a place for you to bring a ship in. And you mentioned coming on an escort carrier. I'm sure it would have been interesting just to see that carrier with all the Japanese planes on the deck of an American carrier. But there's a pretty good story with how you actually got to land that ship, because there were so many ships, not all of them could get a port to land on. Is that right?
Yes. In 1946, there was a lot of ships that were out at sea, 3 miles out of sea, anchored because they had no place to dock them to unload the troops. And a lot of them spent the Christmas out at sea. But I had a commander of the ship I was on told us, he said, I got a baby I've never seen in San Diego, and I got a friend, and he says, we're going to dock this ship somewhere. We were supposed to dock in San Diego. We ended up docking in San Pedro, and we got off the ship the 20th of December.
Anyone that flies in and out of Phoenix, I'm sure sees the Barry Goldwater Terminal here, and they remember him running for president. They know he was a senator from Arizona for a long time. And you got a flight because of him at one point. Tell me that story about Barry Goldwater and how he helped you out.
When I came home from the service, he was there in San Pedro, and he said, I'm from Phoenix, and he said, any veteran from Arizona, I'll fly you to Phoenix for nothing. I just jumped on the plane with him and without even telling him that I was going until I came back.
So you had a couple of fortuitous turns there. The commander of that ship had some friends in high places to bring it into port, and then all of a sudden Barry Goldwater shows up to take you home. That was pretty special. You know, the other question that comes to mind for me, spending all that time on that ship with all those Japanese airplanes on the deck, did you ever get a chance to go nose around and look at those? Because I'm sure there was some curiosity.
We had very rough weather, and you couldn't stand on the deck because you'd be washed overboard. So I did see the planes, but we had rough weather coming all the way across, and the bow of that ship would almost take on water, and you didn't want to get on there because you'd get swept off. So the planes were there, and you looked at them, and that's it.
Yeah, that would be good enough reason for me. When you think back about World War II now, and I know you went on to serve as well during the Korean War, but what makes you proud to be a World War II veteran? What do you take pride in? What do you think people should remember about you and your brothers and everybody else who served during that time?
I had the good fortune to go and lay the wreath on the World War II Memorial this Veterans Day. I was in Washington, D.C., and I met quite a few World War II veterans, but we're getting far and few between. If you're a World War II veteran, your minimum age is about 88 now, so we're going home to the Lord, and there's not many of us left.
And I can see that makes you emotional. What was that like to lay that wreath? Because you're representing a lot of people when you do that.
A very moving situation. I represented the PVA, and by doing that, I had three photographers and a videographer follow me for an hour around the memorial. It was a very honor, great honor to do that.
And you mentioned the PVA, and some people might not know what the PVA is. That's Paralyzed Veterans of America. Maybe some people can guess from the name, but why does that organization exist? You've been involved for over three decades. What is PVA all about, and what do people need to know about it?
PVA has existed since February of 1946. After World War II, they brought all these veterans that were paralyzed, either from the neck down or from the waist down. And our organization is the only veterans organization that's chartered by Congress. We see that the veterans are getting the right medical care. They haven't found a cure for paraplegia. They're working on it, and our organization has spent millions of dollars to try and find a cure, but still haven't got to where we can walk. I've seen them computerized walking, but it takes about an hour to go 20 feet, so that's not walking in my book.
So basically the mission of the PVA is to make sure that paralyzed veterans are cared for, first of all, and that all the money that you raise, or the point of raising money, is hopefully to someday find a cure for that paralysis?
Yes, to find a cure. We also work with the spinal cord injury hospitals to see that the veterans get treated right and everything. And we have groups that make annual visits to all the spinal cord injuries. Like in California, go on Palo Alto, one in Long Beach, one in San Diego, one in Albuquerque, one in Denver. So they have certain hospitals that specialize in just treating paralyzed veterans.
I'm really interested in some of the interactions that you've had with other paralyzed veterans, but I think for people to understand the significance, they should probably have a taste of when you became paralyzed, because it wasn't your time in the service. Almost 60 years ago now. Tell me what happened. You were in a car with your father?
And there was three railroad tracks, and on the first two there were freight trains parked, and then on the third line that we would have crossed was the main line, and there was a passenger train that was doing 55 in a 35-mile zone because he was behind schedule. The boxcars blocked the vision, and there was no signals or light there at all. The locomotive T-boned the 35 forward, and that's where I ended up paralyzed. For 3 days, they gave me up as deceased, and I fooled them, and I'm still here today.
Man, you don't hear that story every day. And your father was killed in that accident, so they think you're dead for 3 days. I can't imagine what it's like to come to, demonstrate to them you're not dead, but find out my father's dead and I'm paralyzed. How did you possibly deal with that realization?
First place, you're kind of doped up and everything, and you don't know what's going on. Then my brother, when I came to, he said, Dad got killed when he got hurt, and that's the first I'd known about it. And the engineer of that train was on his last run before retirement, and he knew me on top of it.
Where did this happen?
Right up in Prescott, right in town. And he was on his last run before retirement, and he didn't blow the whistle or anything, yet the priest said the whistle was so loud it disrupted his mass that morning. It was on a Sunday morning. And what actually happened, when he seen me flying through the air, he recognized me, and then he lost it.
He come and visit you?
No, because after I came through, they sent me to Long Beach, California, which was a premier spinal cord injury unit. 11 months to the day I got hurt, I was home, and I've been home ever since.
I mean, there's so many questions that come to mind, because this is a long time. I mean, we're talking about, this is 56 years ago now that this happened. And I'm sure somewhere along the way, some doctors told you what they thought was going to happen. What was the prognosis for you? Give me some examples of some of the things doctors have shared with you or told you to expect that somehow you've overcome and you're still here at 91.
Well, I first got hurt, and I was over there, and I seen all these guys were paralyzed, mostly from the war. I asked the doctor, what's my prognosis? How long do you think I'm going to live? He said, you'll live a good 3 to 5 years.
You've been paralyzed from, what, the waist down since 1958?
It hasn't gotten any better. It hasn't gotten any worse.
Well, but that's the physical challenge. I've met enough people that have gone through this. And in fact, just a few weeks ago, Johnny Erickson Tata was at my daughter's school and spoke. And she's such an advocate for people with disabilities and people dealing with paraplegia or even quadriplegia. It seems that there is an even bigger sometimes emotional and mental battle that you have to fight, and clearly you've been able to win for all these years. How do you do that? What keeps you going for all these years, considering what you were facing?
Don't dwell on the things you can't do, and make the best of what you can do. And that's been my theory. Don't feel sorry for yourself because you in the condition you're in, but do the best of it and don't give up.
And I hear you say that, and I have to believe you. But I imagine there are probably some times where that wasn't very easy. Were there some times where you felt like this was just too much or you couldn't do this anymore?
No, I've never had that feeling. Tomorrow's always a new day. I mean, being paralyzed is a big trauma. But now that I look back, being blind or being deaf is worse than being paralyzed as far as I'm concerned, because you can't hear or see the beauty of the world. New injuries, when I talk to them, I tell them, don't dwell on the things that you can't do. Do the things that you can do and do them the best of your ability. And don't lay there and feel sorry for yourself, because it's not doing you any good and nobody else cares.
Because I could go to a guy who just got blown up in Iraq or Afghanistan and tell him the same thing that you just said. It wouldn't mean that coming from me. It wouldn't mean as much. But when it comes from you, someone who's lived for over a half century with paralysis, I'm sure it means something. How many times do you think you've had the chance to talk to one of these paralyzed veterans?
When I was in the hospital this last time, a nurse came to me and said, I got a new injury here. Will you go talk to him? And I said, I'd be glad to. and just help another soul. Let him know what he's facing, and then let him know what he can do about it. He's just trying to help the individual by mentoring to him and saying, these things you can't do, give them, don't dwell on them, and the things you can do, enjoy them.
What do you think we need to know about these veterans who come back in that kind of condition, who you're trying to encourage? What can we do to support them and not make things more difficult for them?
I think you can encourage them and don't feel sorry for them. They've gone through enough of that. As far as I'm concerned, the way I felt, don't remind you of it. Encourage them that life is still worthwhile living.
It occurs to me that you served our country in World War II and Korea, but you've probably served a whole lot more of our veterans in all these decades since. What are you most proud of? What gives you the most satisfaction?
I'd have to think about that. There's so many things. I raised two stepchildren, and one of them put 20 years in the service, and the other one's an attorney, and they're still here in Phoenix with me, and I've had a good life.
And it doesn't seem like you're done yet. What keeps you going? What are you still looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to tomorrow. You never know what's in store, and just keep going, and that's the way I feel about it. I'm not ready to check out yet.
Well, we're not ready for that either. Are there things that you would say you've learned because you've had to live with paralysis that you might not have learned or understood otherwise?
Oh, yes, I think that's very true. I mean, the way of life and everything, I mean, it changes your life upside down, and you have to learn to get along with it, and society has done a lot of improvements, say for the paralyzed veterans, but also it's helped the civilian population. You take like a person that can't pick up his feet real, that shuffles. They got curb cuts where they couldn't cross the street because of the curb, or a mother with a baby carriage. We've accomplished a lot of things that we fought for ourselves, but it's been a blessing to everybody else.
Well, I'm glad you pointed that out to us, because I'm sure a lot of people have not realized that. We just kind of take it for granted, and there are so many things that are a result of the work you and the Paralyzed Veterans of America have done. There's a good parallel, too, there to what you did in World War II in Korea, because our lives would not be the same. Our country would not be the same without your service and sacrifice. And I'm sure that people, paralyzed or otherwise, have been inspired by hearing you share your outlook. That's Frank Rego, 91 years old, of Phoenix, Arizona. If you want to see what he looks like, pull up Hometown Heroes on Facebook or go to hometownheroesradio.com, where I also have a link to information on the Paralyzed Veterans of America. That's the organization that Frank's been involved with now for more than 50 years, and I'm sure they'd love to have your support with your year-end giving. You're also going to find online some info on the spot that we're going to visit when we come back. I'm going to take you to the giant side of Texas, as they call it, where you can explore a chapter of World War II history that a lot of people don't even know about. How could you be a World War II pilot without a propeller? Some of you are figuring that out right now, and we'll explain when Hometown Heroes comes down the home stretch right after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I hope that you were as moved by hearing Frank Rego tell his story as I was to sit with him there in his home in Phoenix. A reminder of some of the things that so many of us take for granted. In his case, it was the use of his legs that he lost. In the case of thousands of Americans who became prisoners of war in World War II, it was the temporary loss of that precious gift of freedom that so changed their perspective. And one of the most powerful POW stories you're ever going to hear is coming to the big screen this Christmas. Unbroken is due out in theaters Christmas Day. And next week on Hometown Heroes, to get you in the spirit for that, we're going to revisit my interview with the late Louis Zamperini, the man whose true story inspired that film. I'm looking forward to sharing that with you. But for the rest of the program today, we're going to hear about a place that brings history alive in a really powerful way, way out in West Texas. You know, I travel a lot to announce sporting events on the radio, and believe it or not, I had more hiccups and challenges on a trip to Lubbock, Texas and back than I've had, I think, in the last 5 years combined. Delays, cancellations, missing bags, an all-night Greyhound bus ride complete with a crying baby behind me? Yeah, no lie. But one of the things that made it all worth it was a chance to visit the Silent Wings Museum, which preserves the history of the glider program in World War II. If you're a longtime listener to Hometown Heroes, you've heard from men who piloted those powerless gliders on D-Day and in other invasions. You've heard from guys who flew the C-47s that towed them, and men who were passengers in those gliders ready to jump out and fight the enemy when they landed. It was a revolutionary idea at the time, but it's a facet of World War II that many people remain unaware of today. If you visit the city-owned Silent Wings Museum in Lubbock, Texas, you'll learn all about it. And that's what we're going to do right now with Eddie Grigsby, the assistant museum's manager. He took me on a grand tour, pointing out all the displays, even the gorgeous watercolors of glider scenes. And who were they painted by? A longtime Disney animator, Dale Oliver, who had been a glider pilot in World War II. All kinds of different facets to this, and the museum really captures a great snapshot of how World War II impacted everybody in all walks of life. But let's start by asking Eddie what he gets out of it, working at the Silent Wings Museum every day.
For me, it's the enjoyment and the satisfaction of doing something that preserves, you know, we have our history that we have. I take care of a museum that has one of the largest collections of the World War II Military Glider Pilots Association. They have entrusted us with carrying on and showing and talking and telling about their legacy and what they did during the war.
You've taken me through the museum. I've seen a lot of the different displays here, and it's very impressive. It's all state-of-the-art. It's up-to-date. It's sharp-looking. What impresses you the most as you see the different displays and manage them, and you hear the stories from these veterans, and you understand what all they did during World War II? What kind of takes you back and says, wow, that's impressive?
Well, for me, it's the CG-4A, the glider, that because they had it on display at their museum when it was at Terrell, and they're the ones who actually did the complete restoration of it. And that's quite an undertaking. I mean, they've probably got 5,000 to 6,000 hours of just labor of work from them putting that thing together and putting it in the kind of condition that it's in now.
And how'd that happen that the museum came here to Lubbock? I know that this was a huge training area during the war for Silent Wings, for glider pilots and glider infantry and all that. But how did it actually become a city-owned museum here in Lubbock?
Well, the Glider Pilots Association, when they originally opened in Terrell, Texas in 1984, the museum operated there. They started to look and realize that they needed to find more of a permanent home for it, especially as they were getting a little bit older, and they just needed someone to be the caretakers for. And they approached a couple of entities, which City of Lubbock was one. There was a museum in Atlanta that they approached, and also the museum in New Orleans. And the City of Lubbock, we worked out a deal with them. Reason being is about the glider pilots. There was 6,000 of them that were trained, and about 80% came through Lubbock. So a lot of them had a tie here to Lubbock. They've been through. And it also brought back some of our history back to Lubbock. It brought back a time when the city had a lot of growth during the war effort. The base was here from 42 to 45. And it just brought a lot of prosperous times. So it was a good fit. They needed someone to look after it, and it was a good fit for the city to get it, to bring it back, and to preserve our history.
I'm sure that was a significant investment on the part of the city. Does it seem like it's been worth it to you? What do you see as the fruits of that investment?
The fruits of investment is we saved a part of our history. This museum also comes back, and it presents a quality of life issues for the City of Lubbock. We have a world-class museum. Everyone tells us that when we come through that they're really amazed that this is a first-class act museum. And to me, that just adds to the benefit of being a citizen of Lubbock.
I'm sure you've had a chance to interact with some of the glider pilots or the glider infantry, the guys that actually worked in these situations, and you have some scenes that are set out there, some kind of recreations of what these guys would encounter in combat. What's it like to watch those guys who actually lived this 70 years ago come through and take in some of your displays?
It's very pleasing. You do get a little bit of criticism when you come through, because you'll have one of the gentlemen said, well, we got the uniform wrong, or, you know, they'll kind of correct us. But then when you talk to another one, their uniform, they say, no, we're spot on. But we have to realize that not every GI had the same experience. There wasn't enough uniforms to go around, so they were mixing and matching and they were doing different things. But we just try to stay consistent with a plan, and if someone comes in and they see that we might be off on something, we take that in consideration and we'll correct it. You'd mentioned about the impact of the glider pilot or the rider. And then when you see them walk up to a case and you see them look at their kids and their grandkids and say, that was what I did, and you see their eyes, or you see them come up to a display and they read something and they start to cry, you know, it pulls at your heartstrings. But, you know, it was a tough situation and they did it. And, you know, we're here to try to let people know, the future generations, what these folks did.
Do you ever sit there and watch those moments, or even watch some of the great videos that you guys have here to educate people and to help them learn the history? You ever sit there and say, man, I don't know if I could have done that, to fly a powerless plane or go in with really no defenses, not knowing where I'm going to end up, and then try to fight my way to someplace else where there are more Americans?
I'll be honest with you. You know, I'm a little bit older than they were when they did this. Looking at it now, there was probably no way you could get me to do what they did. It was truly, you had to volunteer for this. It was 100% volunteer to be a glider pilot. And it was the first time in history that a pilot was trained for one-way missions and to be a combat soldier once they were on the ground. They were just a regular foot soldier to regroup, to work their way across the enemy lines, back into territory, get to a base, to get another glider, to fly another mission. Some of these guys flew several flights in one mission, which is, to me, is amazing. It's just kind of like, ooh, I got shot at. Let me go get some more of that, you know? But yeah, they were quite the incredible folks.
And one thing I know you've learned is that some of these guys actually enjoyed those landings, or the fact that they pretty much had to crash that thing to bring it in. And you kind of have a recreation in one of your rooms here of how they could actually use enemy obstructions to their benefit.
Right. There was the item mainly is the Rommel's asparagus. The enemy, the Germans, were very mathematical, and they would put them up in even rolls and cross sections.
And just so everybody knows, this isn't actually asparagus you can eat we're talking about. Tell them what Rommel's asparagus was.
A Rommel's asparagus is probably about a 30-foot pine tree with all the branches cut off, so it's one huge fence post. And probably about 15 feet of that post was buried in the ground, and another 15 feet sticking up top. If you were lucky just to find a field with Rommel's asparagus, they could use that to shear the wings off so they could actually stop quicker in a smaller field. The only time that it was a downside is when they actually mined the tops of some of the asparagus. When they were learning what was going on later, they started actually setting some mines to some of them. That made it more difficult.
And you have basically a recreation of one of those gliders coming in where the wing basically gets torn apart by that big pine tree, but that actually helped them slow down and not topple over or go in head first or have a rougher landing, huh?
Yes. I mean, if they would hit it evenly, it would slow it down. If you hit one on one side, it would spin it around and around. But the whole thing was to try to come in and get your cargo, whether it is a Jeep, a trailer, or 13 infantrymen, get them on the ground, get it safely so it could be used effective.
And you couldn't really practice that kind of landing with those obstructions in the way. These guys were pretty gutty. You also, it's not just veterans and their families that come through here. You get a lot of school tour groups, and I'm sure every school in Lubbock is sending kids here. What kind of moments, light bulb moments, do you see for those kids? And there are some questions maybe that you think back on that say, yeah, it was pretty neat when I got to answer that question or saw the kids putting this and this together.
You know, it's amazing when you see, the kids, we get all ages, but when they start putting together the Axis and Allied powers, who was who, and then they realize Italy was part of the Axis powers, it starts to click. You see the history, the stuff that they've been learning, and they start seeing things from the history that just reinforces it, and you get to see that. And there's a lot of questions. I still get, I'm in my 40s, and I also have some of the younger kids ask me, what did I do during World War II? You know, it's just like, I'm not old enough yet, so.
Now I can tell my kids I'm not the only one. Thanks for that. Do you have a favorite display or element of this museum that when you're, trying to convince someone to come see it, you're like, oh, you got to come see this?
I would say it's our crown jewel. It's, once again, it's our CG-4A glider. You know, we call it a cargo, the CG stands for cargo glider. But if it was used in, it was definitely could be a combat glider, because when you were shot at, but you had no way of returning fire, It was used in all aspects of invasions. But when you start to consider that we have one of seven, when I first started in the museum, we were one of five of gliders complete in the world. We've been helping other museums. We have helped the Glider Trust in Charterhall, England, put a glider together, and they've been helping us put a Horsa together here, sending us parts and components and blueprints.
I was wondering why I didn't see a Horsa out there, but you guys are actually adding a Horsa.
Right. We have the we have a cockpit and some of the fuselage ribs and stuff that's out there. It's kind of a slow going because we have to use volunteers to help us do woodwork and so forth. But our goal is to get the nose cone and the fuselage, and I probably won't get much more than that because our hangar gallery isn't big enough to have both the Horsa, because it's a huge bird, and the CG-4A on display at the same time.
How often do you have people come in here and it's clear to you that they had no idea this was happening during the war, that these glider invasions were actually taking place, and when they realized how frequent it was, and it wasn't just in Europe and it was all over the place? How often do you see those people that are just kind of wowed by all of it?
Almost weekly. We'll have someone come through and they didn't realize that the glider program even existed. Like I said, in the whole mobilization of our forces, you know, you're just talking about 6,000 glider pilots. Some 14,000 gliders were built during the war effort. It was one of those things that there wasn't a lot of press on it, but it was used, like I said, in every major invasion of the war. So it was used to supply, to carry troops, and to also evacuate. We have a whole display on the snatch pickup, to where they actually would fly over and pull one up off the ground out of a combat zone, and you could take out wounded and so forth, evacuate.
Maybe it's commonplace to you now because you've been around the museum long enough, but isn't that a little crazy sounding? I mean, to have a tow plane come in, hook something that doesn't have any power, and yank it on out of there? I mean, it sounds a little crazy, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, the guys who sat around and thought this up and tried to practice it. But they basically used, you know, 1920, 1930s airmail technology, and then added a big winch to the back of a C-47 that kind of fed out a little bit of line at the same time it had drag pulling forward. So if you can think of a big fishing reel kind of letting out but pulling in at the same time, you could just pull it off the ground.
Feel free to add anything else that I haven't asked you about, but I know you guys have something coming up here during the holidays, and maybe some of our listeners in different parts of the country are thinking, hey, this would be a good idea for us to try here in our community. Tell me what you guys do at Christmas time around here at the museum to kind of bring back that spirit of the 1940s.
Well, we have a program that we call the Foxhole Christmas, and it's geared about making Christmas ornaments, decorations, and stuff for your tree out of regular household items or thing that you might find, scraps of metal, different lids from your mason jars and so forth, and what you can do. And the main reason why we focus on that is the whole mobilization of the 1940s is everything was rationed. Everything from rubber to sugar to you name it, there was pretty much a ration on it. And you just couldn't go out and buy something. You had to either use a ration stamp for it, or you just had to wait till you could find somewhere it was used. So we tried to do programs where we do a lot of the home front, where everyone took part, where they were either, once again, using things that weren't not normally used and how to decorate it to make it look like something else so you could actually still have ornaments because you couldn't go out and buy any.
I'm sure a lot of people get a whole lot of perspective from engaging in that, and that makes me wonder about you living this, breathing it every day. How has your immersion in World War II history changed your perspective?
Well, I think for me, I think I'm a lot more, I recycle a lot more. I look at things and I look at other uses instead of just going out and buying something. I hang on to a few things. So I think just learning what they did and then learning, you know, what's around your house and what you can keep recycling, keep reusing. It's, I think that's something that I think everyone can actually learn a little bit.
No doubt. And I like that point. It's not just about learning about the past so we can say we know a little more history. It's about applying the lessons of history to our present and to our future. And the Silent Wings Museum is doing a wonderful job of that in Lubbock, Texas. Different kind of show today, but I trust you got as much out of it as I did. Next week, we'll talk about Unbroken, the movie version of Louis Zamperini's story. It comes out on Christmas Day, and we'll get you ready by listening to Louis himself. I pride myself in bringing you brand new interviews every week, but I'm willing to make an exception next time for a guy who isn't here anymore to tell his story. And as the world focuses on a movie that depicts some of what happened to him, we're going to listen to what he thought were the most amazing elements of his story and why it was so important to him to share that story with others. I'm looking forward to that, but we're out of time for now. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.